Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayishlach. This is a parent's advisory about this podcast. In this podcast, Dr. Mishhammer Kosoy discusses issues of sexuality and violence that appear in the Torah in a very direct manner. So please be aware of that and make your appropriate decisions about who you're listening to this podcast with. Thank you. In this episode, Dr. Mishhammer Kosoy discusses the rape of Dinah in Parsha Vayishlach. Dr. Mishhammer Kosoy is a member of the Pardes faculty and serves as the Director of Admissions for Pardes. And now, Dr. Mishhammer Kosoy.
Thank you, Larry. This week's Parsha is Vayishlach. It's a very full Parsha with so many wonderful things and good stories, important stories. Friday is, or Shabbos, as well as being a Parsha Vayishlach, is also International Human Rights Day, and the November 25th was the International Day Against Violence in order to stop violence against women, and the 16 days in between are called the Campaign Against Gender-Based Violence. And because of the story that takes place in Chapter 34, and because of the timing, and also because of the class that I'm preparing in my social justice class about sex trafficking, I really found that I was unable to pass over the story of the rape of Dinah. And I hope that... I think that it's possible that today's class won't be as warm and fuzzy as some of the other classes are. I hope that you will indulge me and listen to this podcast about something that really is very, very important, and hopefully you will bring it to your Shabbat table as a provocative discussion that hopefully will also have directions of light and points of light within it. Last week, Vayetze was a birth fest or demographic warfare, depending on how you want to relate to it. During last week's Parsha, Yaakov married both Rachel and Leah, and the struggle between the two for Yaakov's affection took form around a fight for more children. And in that context, Rachel has the affection of Yaakov, and Leah tries to gain Yaakov's affection through the bearing of children, and she manages to do this quite successfully, but also creating tremendous pain for Rachel. So you have the Parsha begins with Leah having four children herself, then Rachel's handmaid having two children on behalf of Rachel, and then Leah's handmaid having two children on behalf of Leah, and then Leah having two more children. And it's at that point when the score is essentially, if you will, 8-2 or 6-0, depending on how you do your counting, that there's this very strange pasuk, which is a setup for our parsha, where it says, V'achar yalda bat v'tikra et shma Dinah. And afterwards, Leah had a daughter, and she was called Dinah. And then the story continues. And that pasuk feels a little bit stuck in there, because unlike the other 10 children who have been born up till this point, each one has a pregnancy and a leida and a naming and an explanation for the name. And here there's this sort of random birth without a pregnancy, without an explanation for the name. And so it burns a little bit to sort of feel what exactly is going on. There's something that's very bothersome about the nature of this birth, something strange about the nature of this birth. And Rashi picks up on that, and he says something that I perceive as very poignant. He says, our rabbis explained that Leah adjudicated a case with herself, right? Picking up on the idea of Dinah. What is the name Dinah? Dinah means judgment. Rashi says, based on the Midrash and Talmud Brachot, that Leah actually judged herself. She did math. She had a prophecy. She understood through magical prophecy that there would be a total of 12 children altogether, and that she already had 6 of them. And so she did the math. She said, if this is a male, Rachel, my sister, will not even be one of the maidservants. And she prayed about it and turned it into a female. So the thing that is amazing about this is that Rachel, that Leah and Rachel are in a the Gemara calls them tzarot. They're co-wives who give each other tzuris. Their job is to, and you feel very much that they are rivals with one another, having a relationship which is characterized by contentiousness. And yet, even in the context of contentiousness and competition, which is what having these children is all about, Leah is able to step back from that moment of her desperate quest to win Yaakov's affection and to see it from the perspective of Rachel and understand that in some ways her win is Rachel's loss, and that there. And she feels the pain of Rachel's loss. And she says, wow, if I have a seventh son, and there are already four sons have been born to the maidservants, that will only leave one child left for Rachel, and that means that Rachel will be even less than the maidservants. How humiliating will that be for Rachel? And Leah makes the ultimate sacrifice for herself. She decides to, in an act of chesed for Rachel, in an act of tremendous kindness towards Rachel, dan din latzma. She makes a judgment upon herself, which is to daven and to ask God to turn the fetus into a girl. And Hashem agrees and turns the fetus into a girl. This is the story, according to Rashi, of the birth of Dina, in which case Dina's birth from the very beginning is a birth that comes out of the context of this struggle, the complex relationship between Din and Chesed. Her name is Judgment, and Leah accepts a judgment upon herself in order to do a Chesed for Rachel, so that there is a complex relationship between Din and Chesed, and it manifests itself in Dina's name, which means judgment. And perhaps that sets us up for the difficulty of this week's story in chapter 34, where Dina bat Leah, who has been born to Jacob, goes out to see the daughters of the land. And when she goes out, Shechem ben Hamor sees her, the Nasi of the Chivi, the prince of the Hittite people, the Chivite people, excuse me, v'yikachotav yishkavotav ya'aneha. He sees her, and he takes her, and he lays with her, and he defiles her. In that very packed pasuk immediately comes afterwards, after this tremendous act of violence, he falls in love with Leah, and he wants to keep her as a wife, and he begs his father, and his father agrees to go to Yaakov and to seek to marry Dina. As if it's not terrible enough that she's been the victim of this torturous violence, v'ya'aneha, that she was, it's translated here in this text as he defiled her, he tortured her. He also asks to marry her. And Yaakov does not exactly know what to do. The children of Yaakov, Yaakov's sons, answer, and they agree to such a thing, but under conditions. They agree under the condition that Shechem ben Hamor and everyone in his town will circumcise themselves, and that will create allow them to create a covenant in which both brothers and sisters, both the sons and daughters of both communities, will marry one another as a sort of intermarrying of the families, and both communities agree to this. I think it's not coincidental, since we're in the context of Human Rights Day, the 16-day campaign against violence for women, that in the December 1st paper of the New York Times tells the story of an Afghani woman who was raped, a married woman who was raped, and then sentenced for adultery to 12 years in jail as a result of her rape. And then she was offered a shortened sentence if she would agree to marry her rapist, just as Shechem ben Hamor has demanded. If you will marry your rapist and take the badge of shame against the family away from them, They'll be willing to shorten the sentence to 4 years, and she actually agrees to it. And in that context of her agreeing to marry her rapist, she also makes the demand, which is similar to the demand in our Persia, that the marriage be mutual, that her brother marries one of the rapist's sister, so that this works in Afghanistan and in other traditional cultures is this sort of serves as a protection for the rape victim, that the rape victim knows that her brother has power over the rapist's sister. And so hopefully that will provoke the rapist to treat the rape victim in a more compassionate way, knowing that his sister will be subject to parallel treatment, if you will. In any case, that's obviously a terrifying text, and in some ways you can sort of feel the echoes of that story in our Parsha, and you can wonder, how can the children of Jacob agree to such a thing? But yet it turns out, you can understand why Shechem ben Hamor agrees to such a thing and how he can understand what's going on. But the sons of Jacob, how could they agree to such a thing? But it turns out it was a ruse, if you will. And to add terror onto terror, after on the third day, after they're in pain, and the people of the city of Shechem are suffering from having circumcised themselves and are trying to heal from having circumcised themselves, that the two sons of Jacob, Shimon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took each man his sword and came upon the city unresisted, and they slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword. And they took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went out. And the sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city, because they had defiled their sister. And they took their sheep and their oxen and their asses, and that which was in the city, and that which was in the field, and all their wealth, and all their little ones, and all their wives. They took captive and plundered all that was in the house. And Yaakov said to Shimon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me to make me odious amongst the inhabitants of the land, among the Knani and the Prizi. And I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house." And the brothers responded, "Should he deal with our sister as with a harlot?" And so the conflict at the end of this story between Jacob and Shimon and Levi, to what extent is this punishment? Shimon and Levi see themselves as justly punishing the crime of Shechem ben Hamor and his community, whereas Jacob sees this as extreme violence, which is also very dangerous. The text leaves it right there, with the brothers getting the last word. Should we deal with our sister as with a harlot? But throughout the text, throughout the remainder of the Bible, in several places, there are hints that the narrator of the text supports or understands the side of Jacob, and on the other hand also understands the side of Shimon and Levi. And so it's not exactly clear which side is vindicated or in the text, but it's very natural to ask the question, what's going on here? I understand killing Shechem ben Hamor, but to kill the entire town? And are they not innocent bystanders? That question is answered by a number of commentators. The one that I would like to focus on today is the Rambam. The Rambam says as follows. He says, there are seven mitzvot that are incumbent on non-Jews, and one of those is sexual morality. Shechem ben Hamor has violated that commandment, and therefore he has incurred the death penalty. But there's another one of those seven, which is dinim, the demand of legislation, that a society cannot be a just society unless they set up a system of law and enforce that system of law in their community. And it turns out, says the Rambam, that because everyone in the community knew what Shechem ben Hamor had done, and they did not cast him out from their midst, and they did not judge him at all, they too have violated one of the seven Noahite laws, and they too have incurred the death penalty. And, says the Rambam, it's our job, as it is incumbent upon the Jewish people, to enforce the seven Noahite mitzvot. If the communities do not enforce them themselves, then it is our job to step forward and to enforce them on their behalf. Now, the Ramban rejects this and suggests that Nachmanides, that that's very extreme, and it is not our job to be enforcers for the world and to coerce and make sure that everyone performs commandments. But my interest is to look for a minute at the Rambam and the logic of what he's suggesting. The logic of what he's suggesting, it seems to me, is a logic that's on the one hand very strict in judgment, extreme in its deen. On the other hand, it also has a kind of chesed. It, in some ways, it is a declaration, a form of expanding this principle that is so dear to us as Jews, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh, that all the Jewish people are responsible one for another, which means that when you sin, it's also I'm also responsible for your sin, and therefore I need to take responsibility to make sure that all of us have a just society, and that is something that comes out of a sense of a family, a sense of interresponsibility, a sense of being one. As it says in the Gemara in Shabbat, Rav and Rabbi Chanina, Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Chaviva taught that whoever can forbid his household to commit a sin but does not is seized for the sins of his household. If he can forbid his fellow citizens, he is seized for the sins of his fellow citizens. If the whole world, he is seized for the sins of the whole world. And this is the idea that the Rambam is suggesting, is that obviously you take a certain responsibility for your children, for your husband, for your family members, to make sure, because our actions represent one another. We because of our intimate relationship and our love for one another, we are interconnected and responsible for one another. And when we say Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh, all of the Jews are responsible one for another, we're saying we also are one big happy family and we have a responsibility for each other's actions. That comes out of a place of chesed, a place of love and kindness for one another. And the Rambam is suggesting that not only is Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh, but Kol Shechem Arevim Zeh Bazeh. Also the community of Shechem is responsible for one another. And similarly, we are responsible for the community of Shechem, that this relationship of emanating circles of love and of kindness, which may cause very harsh judgment, is a responsibility, that is a great human responsibility. And that is, whoa, a lot to handle, especially when you stand here today in the Human Rights Day and during the 16-day campaign against violence for women, to think about the literally millions of women who are being trafficked against their will as prostitutes, that perhaps tens of millions of people, or 10 million children who may be being forced into labor across the world, and to sort of imagine ourselves, not just imagine, to actually understand that we take responsibility for that. But that responsibility comes, certainly it's a deen against us, but it comes from a place of chesed, a place of kindness, a place of love. So again, it seems to me that the story of Dina is a story about the complexity of the relationship between deen and chesed, between kindness and judgment. And in that context, I'd like to bring in one more source, if I could, the Pachad Yitzchak, who is a great thinker of the previous century, who also wrote about this relationship between chesed and deen, which he, ironically, not because he's not writing about our passage at all, sees as parallel to the relationship between licentiousness and murder. He says, the Pachad Yitzchak, the attribute of kindness is really expansiveness, whereas the attribute of judgment is contraction and shrinking, right? This idea of chesed, of drawing your circles outwards and have expanding responsibility, that's expansiveness, whereas the attribute of judgment is contraction and shrinking. And he says it is clear that sexual licentiousness is the refuse of kindness and flows from it. And conversely, murder is the refuse of the attribute of strict judgment and flows from it. That there's a correspondence, sexual licentiousness has in it this idea of licentiousness, just as murder has this idea of strict judgment, and the two are related, interrelated one with the other. And he goes on to say, so if we see that just as on the side of refuse we have found murder for the sake of sexual licentiousness, we have not found sexual licentiousness for the sake of murder. That you often see that the desire for sex turns people to violence in a way more than the need for violence turns people to sex. This is what the Pachad Yitzchak suggests, and he says, conversely, on the side of holiness, we have seen the contraction for the sake of expansiveness, but we have not seen expansiveness for the sake of holiness. That there's a relationship between kindness, between expansiveness and contraction, but there's a relationship which is a relationship of primary and secondary. And he places this in the context of the tefillah, the Amidah that we say three times a day. The first bracha is called the bracha of Avot, the forefathers, and it begins, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu V'Elokei Avoteinu Elokei Avraham Elokei Yitzchak Elokei Yaakov, the God of Avraham and the God of Yitzchak. And tradition tells us that the Avraham represents kindness, chesed, the midah, the characteristic which is primary about Abraham, is that he represents the idea of kindness. And Yitzchak, his symbolic characteristic is that of Deen, of judgment, because of the way he subjected himself to the Akedah, to the binding of Isaac. And so so the blessing puts, again, kindness and judgment in juxtaposition to one another, right next to each other, as if they can coexist in this strange relationship, Elokei Avraham and Elokei Yitzchak. God is a God of kindness and a God of judgment. But, says the Pachad Yitzchak, both of them are held together in the same bracha, but the ending of the bracha, Baruch Ata Hashem Magen Avraham, blessed are you, God, the shield of Abraham. In the final, in the closing of the blessing, only Abraham is mentioned, and Yitzchak is subsumed within Abraham. And that comes to teach us, right, that if, just when you, the signature at the bottom tells you what's primary, and that everything that came before it in some ways came to serve that which is primary. And so, says the Pachad Yitzchak, so too does Deen come to serve, this idea of harsh judgment comes to serve the midah of chesed, which is primary. And my hope is that in each of our lives we should be able to, although there will be a need, certainly, and without taking a position at all on this terrible, this very, very difficult story in Vayishlach about the rape of Dinah and the subsequent very harsh punishment of the people of Shechem ben Hamor, to understand that sometimes punishment, a strict judgment, can come out of a place of chesed, out of a place of love. And there may be points in our life, there surely will be points in our life where we have no choice but to introduce notions of deen and judgment. And it seems obvious to me that one of those places is in the fighting of violence against women and enslaving women. But that strict judgment should always come in the place of and in serving the goal of chesed and kindness, that everything should always be working towards that goal of chesed. So we've seen three times, both in the naming of Dinah and in the rape of Dinah and the subsequent punishment, and then finally through the Pachad Yitzchak, the complex relationship between chesed and deen, the way they interplay with one another and hopefully serve the ultimate goal of chesed. My blessing for you is that you should have a week full of chesed with as little deen as necessary. Thank you very much and Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Dr. Hammer Kosoy. And thank you for tuning in to Pardes from Jerusalem.